This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Cyclone Idai flooding killed 60 people in Malawi and displaced nearly 90,000 households in 15 districts. But it would also have an impact on the general elections held in every 5 years.
That's Lamek Masina reporting from Blantyre. Details next. Also, a new report says Ethiopian garment workers are the lowest paid in the major markets for garment production. And on this, the Muslim Holy Month, we take a look at Ramadan in America. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, as Malawi gears up for elections this month, candidates and voters say flooding from March's cyclone Idai has already hurt the vote. Some registered voters living in evacuation camps lost voting registration certificates in the floodwaters, while candidates say they cannot get their message to would-be supporters living in evacuation camps. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Mafles Kingi from Manjolo village is among thousands of eligible voters still living in evacuation camps 2 months after Cyclone Idai. The tropical storm that hit Mozambique, Malawi and Zimbabwe in March flooded them out of their homes. Kingi says the flood waters also swept away her voter registration and those of 6 other family members. We had no time to rescue our voter certificates, she says, because the house was collapsing. The only thing they could do, says Kingi, was to run for their dear lives. Not having a voter certificate means having to explain why to officials who then look up registration at the polls before they can vote. While Malawi election authorities say it should not prevent voting, the extra step could deter voters, especially those who are not informed. Cyclone Idai flooding killed 60 people in Malawi and displaced nearly 90,000 households in 15 districts. But it could also have an impact on the general elections held in every 5 years. Gladys Ganda is a parliamentary candidate for the ruling Democratic Progressive Party in Nsanje district. She says Cyclone Idai's displacement of people is preventing her from campaigning in affected areas.
In the sense that people are not in their homes. Some people are camping in various camps. And obviously, when you go to do campaign, you're not finding people around that area. And you're also not allowed to do campaign at the camps.
Ganda says not being allowed to campaign in the evacuation camps has made it difficult for candidates like her to promote their platforms. Bizel Bishop, a flood survivor at Bangula evacuation camp, agrees. He says they are not properly getting the issues raised by the candidates because the candidates are not allowed to campaign at the camp. And returning home is also difficult, says Bishop, because there they have no food. They can only wait for the government to help their return home where they'll be able to attend campaign rallies. Lucy Nsiane is a commissioner for Malawi's southern flood hit Chikwawa district. He says allowing campaign rallies at the evacuation camps would bring chaos as they are already too crowded. But Malawi's Electoral Commission says banning campaign rallies at evacuation camps deprives the flood survivors of being informed voters. Sam Alufandika is the commission's chief elections officer.
As Malawi Electoral Commission, we haven't received this officially, but we'll do our own investigation to find out why they are not allowed to go to the camps, because everybody is supposed to be reached out. They have to know what these candidates are offering for them to have an informed choice on polling day, and those who are affected by floods cannot be left out.
Malawi's government has announced that it will start closing the evacuation camps on May 14, just 1 week before elections. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
A new report says Ethiopian garment workers are the lowest paid in the major markets for garment production. Researchers at the Stern Center for Business and Human Rights at New York University say Ethiopian workers earn an average of $26 a month. That compares with an average of $340 a month in China. In neighboring Kenya, garment workers earn an average of $207 a month. The report says the Ethiopian government's drive to create a garment manufacturing industry faces a range of challenges. Among them is that political reforms have allowed ethnic animosity to bubble up and become entwined with labor issues, according to the report. The authors recommend several changes that could help the industry grow and increase prosperity. Among them is addressing ethnic tensions and establishing a minimum wage that ensures decent living standards. They also say foreign companies operating in Ethiopia should offer decent subsidized housing for workers and promote more Ethiopians into middle management jobs. South Africa's chief opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, or DA, is confident of loosening the grip of the ruling African National Congress, or ANC, on the country in tomorrow's election. The DA's promises to voters include clean and more efficient governance, long prison sentences for corrupt politicians, better policing, an increase in poverty grants, and more support for small businesses. But political analysts say the DA has failed to capitalize on the chaotic rule of former President Jacob Zuma, which was characterized by high-level corruption and waning support for the ANC. Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
One opinion poll puts current support for the DA at just 15%. If correct, it's a shocking decline for a party that just 2 years ago ousted the ANC in several cities following local government elections. Analysts say the overall competence of Jacob Zuma's replacement, Cyril Ramaphosa, has been a major blow to the ANC's main opposition. But DA spokesperson Solly Malatsi says surveys showing shrinking support for his party are wrong.
Even in terms of our own internal polling, we are on the right trajectory to maintain our growth.
He's confident that the DA will improve on its impressive performance in the municipal polls of 2016, when it won almost 27% of the vote. But political experts say even the party's traditional white suburban support base is disenchanted with the DA's recent infighting. Last year, it fired its own mayor of Cape Town, accusing her of corruption, and senior DA officials have in recent years made statements that offended many black South Africans. Malatsi acknowledges that cases such as this have been bad for his party.
Look, I think at the time that they happened, they were a difficult period. But subsequent to that, there's been very great momentum in the party to recover some of the losses that may have happened with it. And
research indicates many citizens haven't decided yet which parties to support. Malatsi says the DA is trying to win last-minute votes by emphasizing its excellent record in the only province it controls, the Western Cape. Both independent and state analysis shows the region to be the best in South Africa at managing public funds and service delivery.
For instance, Western Cape has the highest percentage of households with access to water and sanitation. It has the highest number of households with access to electricity.
The Western Cape also has the lowest unemployment rate in the country, proving, says Malatsi, that the DA is good at creating jobs. This may be true, say analysts, but the DA still has to contend with Ramaphosa's surging popularity, something that clearly irritates Malatsi.
His fascination with portraying Ramaphosa as the Messiah is quite frankly naive, because it is still the ANC under Ramaphosa that is not taking decisive action to deal with corrupt elements in its own ranks because of the...
The DA also has to combat rising sentiment that the only way to keep radical, racist and sometimes violent smaller parties away from power is to vote ANC. But Malatsi says the less votes the ANC gets, the better for South Africa.
It will strengthen opposition parties, and that means that there will be more accountability, because nothing scares the ANC more than losing power.
The DA is confident that South Africans will eventually reward it with power because its track record shows it has the ability to take the country forward.
We can run good governments, we can run clean administration, and we deliver services, and our approach to redress is to uplift the lives of mostly poor South Africans who are black.
Malatsi says his party will prove its detractors wrong when it gets even more of the vote than it did last time around, retains the Western Cape, and wins at least two additional provinces. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
The government of South Sudan has set up a committee to verify the authenticity of claims for payments submitted by Ugandan traders who say they supplied goods to South Sudan before the 2013 civil unrest. South Sudan officials announced the committee at a meeting with Ugandan legislators. Close to 300 Ugandans demand compensation from South Sudan over goods supplied to the government. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
For close to 9 years, a number of Ugandan companies have claimed that they supplied goods to South Sudan but have never received payment. A select committee set up by Uganda Parliament is examining the claims, which total about $41 million. The committee follows a memorandum of understanding between Uganda and South Sudan, guaranteeing the payment of the traders. Under the memorandum, Uganda is to pay the traders and Juba will repay the loan with 6% interest within 5 to 10 years. Although the Uganda government is examining claims by only 10 companies, more than 300 traders have filed claims. This prompted a meeting between Uganda Parliament's Select Committee and a number of South Sudan officials to verify the authenticity of the claims. Anne-Marie Nankabira is the chairperson of the Select Committee.
These are ones saying that we were at this level of payment. Some had been issued with checks that bounced. Others had bank guarantees that failed. Then we say, can we have this category list to do background check?
Gok Makak Mayol is South Sudan's Deputy Minister of Finance and Planning. He told the Select Committee that his government has set up a 5-member committee to verify the Ugandan traders' claims.
We will, in our committee, make sure that if we verify the list, then we need to talk. Because if you are bringing the food, in Numele, where in our border they have to register what truck, what is the number of that truck. All this is all there.
The officials on the committee are drawn from South Sudan's Ministries of Finance and Planning, Defence and Veteran Affairs. Matthias Mpuga is a member of the Ugandan committee. He has asked that the verification be expedited since the matter has been pending for so long.
But we cannot pay until the government of South Sudan has accepted that, yes, these were genuine, you know, people that are owed. Otherwise, we shall pay here. So we only ask for the Parliament of South Sudan to move to push the government to have the committee in place to work with our other joint committee from Uganda. So that, in fact, we are praying that before we end the budget period, which is this May, the approvals have been made.
Anthony Makana is the Speaker of the South Sudan Transitional National Assembly. He has pledged to ensure that all authentic traders' claims are fully paid.
I want to apologize on behalf of our people that for the suffering, maybe people did not get their payment. I think it is almost 9-10 years, isn't it? It is a very long period. But this parliament will also support our parliament in Uganda.
The companies that have submitted claims reportedly supplied maize and sorghum to 10 South Sudan states under the Strategic Grains Reserves supplies. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Nineteen past the hour, you're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. The death toll from Sunday's tanker truck explosion in Niger's capital Niamey has risen to 60. Officials today said the number of deaths is likely to rise because of the severe burns many victims suffered. A fuel tanker overturned Sunday night not far from the airport in Niamey. Scores of people gathered to collect the spilled fuel, and witnesses say a motorcycle was left running too close to the spill and sparked the explosion. More than 50 people died on the scene. As the Muslim holy month of Ramadan began this week, Muslim Americans of diverse backgrounds and national origins gathered in Islamic centers across the U.S. to break their dawn to dusk fast, perform congressional night prayers, and help the poor. President Donald Trump has sent the warmest greetings to all Muslims observing the holy month of Ramadan. The White House has been celebrating Ramadan since 1996, but President Thomas Jefferson hosted the first White House iftar dinner in 1805. VOA's Mohammed Al-Shinawi takes a look at Ramadan in America.
Perhaps nowhere in the world is the diversity among Muslims is represented than in the United States, where American Muslims have their roots in more than 50 countries around the world. Despite such diversity, during the month of Ramadan, their feeling of unity is especially strong. Imam Abdullah Khouj is president of the Islamic Center in Washington.
People from all around the world gather in one place, and we do all feel like we are one people, regardless of the distance and regardless of the geographical areas.
Muslims observe Ramadan with rituals that bridge many differences. Families shop for halal food, they prepare iftar dinners to break their daily fast, help the poor, and perform nightly prayers in mosques and Islamic centers. But Muslim Americans practice an extra ritual during Ramadan. Imam Shakir Sayyid is the president of Dar al-Hijra Islamic Center in Virginia.
We host iftar for non-Muslim neighbors right here in the mosque, and we reach out to non-Muslim organizations, churches, synagogues, and other civic organizations to tell them what Ramadan is about.
With the growing visibility and influence of Muslims in the American society, American presidents since President Bill Clinton in 1996 have sent Muslims Ramadan greetings and invited their leaders to White House for an iftar dinner. President Donald Trump has sent warmest greetings to all Muslims observing the holy month of Ramadan. In a statement reads in part, "Throughout this month, we all have an opportunity to reflect on the blessings we have been given and to work toward greater fellowship with one another. Together, in the spirit of Ramadan, we can achieve a more harmonious and respectful society." Last Ramadan, President Trump hosted his first White House iftar dinner.
Tonight, as we enjoy a magnificent dinner at the White House, let us strive to embody the grace and goodwill that mark the Ramadan season.
While annual White House iftar dinners only began a few decades ago, Thomas Jefferson, the third American president, hosted the first iftar dinner in 1805 to welcome the Tunisian ambassador, Suleiman Melimeli. Jefferson adjusted the timing of the state meal to after sunset to accommodate the Muslim ambassador's Ramadan tradition. Mohammed Al-Shinawi, VOA News, Washington.
Zimbabwe has clamored for outside investment in recent years, but villagers north of the capital are resisting a Chinese mining project they say will spoil the environment and fail to bring them much benefit. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
Those are villagers from Domboshava, a rocky area north of Zimbabwe's capital, disputing a Chinese company's decision to start quarry mining. 70-year-old Florence Nyamande is among those saying no to the proposed project by Ayua Juan Company.
The Chinese are the money mongers of the Zimbabweans. They take the riches here, they take it to China. They don't develop our places, so we don't need them here. Seriously, with a deeper heart, with a deeper mind, seriously, we are disappointed. We said no and no, and that is multiplicated no.
The villagers do not think Ayua Jianye will create the 500 jobs in the area it promised. They also say the quarry mining will leave large ponds filled with dirty water. Zimbabwe Deputy Minister of Information Energy Mutodi, who is the parliament member for the area, is also against the $500 million quarry mining project. He says he is not going against President Emmerson Mnangagwa's mantra that Zimbabwe is open for business.
It's open to business, but not business that is going to affect our environment. The people it's unanimous. We want to preserve the environment. We want our community to develop, yes, but let our environment remain intact. We cannot have a situation where people come here, mine, and take away the proceeds, enjoy the proceeds in other countries, yet our people remain poor.
Mutodi notes that the Chinese company has advertised for only 40 jobs in the area, less than one-tenth of what it promised. Percy Mudzidzwa, whose company Geo Global Environmental Solutions is representing the Chinese firm, rejects the allegations that 20,000 people would be affected by the 33-hectare mining project. Some locals say the project will affect a graveyard and a natural spring. Mudzidzwa says that is not the case.
Even a grave is not going to be moved. But there's a misconception of saying we propose that the graves will be fenced. There's a spring which is just above the gravesite. We also propose that water will be fenced too.
Now the project awaits for the country's Environmental Management Agency to make a final call if the Chinese company can go ahead. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Tomas Blondet, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa. The Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you. Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Yeah.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.